Thank you for this opportunity to present my views on opposition to Zionism. I'd like to briefly introduce where I come from. It would be a long story, but to make that story short, I had an upbringing in a fairly typical liberal Jewish family in the USA, where it was almost taken for granted that we were politically progressive, meaning we opposed nuclear weapons, we supported social welfare programs, we didn't like the dictatorships around the world being supported by the US government, but Israel was a blind spot, or worse. Because I was brought up to take for granted that the Jews of the world need the state of Israel to protect us from some endemic anti-Semitism. But that belief was shaken by several aspects of my life. First, although I had some marginal experience of anti-Semitism, it just seemed insignificant compared to the systematic racism against black people in the USA, and especially by comparison to the extermination of the indigenous people, which became more apparent to me with the rise of the American Indian movement, which, by analogy to the book that Uri, the previous speaker, mentioned, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And then, for me, the turning point was the Vietnam War, when I became centrally involved in the movement to oppose that war. And this opened up my eyes and ultimately changed my view of everything, my view of progress, of Western civilization, of science and technology, and eventually, my view of Israel. Because if I identified with the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, then what did that mean for Israel? It became inescapable that a country I regarded as my potential protector became an embarrassment, or worse, it became part of the enemy. And I met Palestinian activists through that general anti-imperialist movement against the Vietnam War. That was back in the 60s. I'll spare you the rest of the history and move on to my talk about Western support for Zionism, implications for strategy. As the previous speaker explained, the Zionist project has gained systematic support from Western governments. All of us in this room could easily make a list illustrating that support. For example, the $5 billion a year from the USA, military supplies, including from the UK, even the equipment to start up the nuclear weapons program in Israel, which we recently learned about, a quasi-honorary membership of the European Union, whereby Israel has been entitled to apply for research funding, as if it were a European country. EU denunciations of Palestinian terrorism as the cause of the conflict between the Palestinians and Israel. And perhaps most recently, the EU's collective punishment of the Palestinians for electing the wrong government. Now, how should we explain the support? The reasons go back to the origins of Zionism and have expanded in recent years. I will very briefly try to tell that story, and especially I will try to draw analogies between the strategies of Zionism as occupation and the wider war on terror. The answer to the question is crucial for how we develop more effective solidarity with the Palestinian struggle for national liberation, and how we resist imperial plunder in general. If I were speaking to a mainly Jewish audience, which unfortunately I rarely have the opportunity to do because I don't get invited, then I would emphasize issues that they would find uncomfortable. Here, I understand I'm speaking to a predominantly Muslim audience, so I'll take the opportunity to speak to issues that you might find difficult, especially near the end of my talk. Because I think we take for granted we oppose Zionism, but what does that mean? Now, as Roland already explained, Zionism was a racist colonial project, which guaranteed the hostility of the Arab world. Zionism has always attributed the persecution of the Jews to an innate anti-Semitism. This was later projected onto the entire Palestinian population to explain its hostility to being colonized, as if colonization wasn't enough of an explanation. In parallel, the Zionist project eliminated the indigenous Arab Jews as a cultural category, the category with which Uri Davis identifies from his origins. The Arab Jews were pressed to become new Jews according to the Zionist form of European colonialism. That is, Jews who triumph over their persecution by colonizing the land of Israel. And when Jews from Arab countries emigrated to Israel, they were systematically humiliated about their Arab culture. If you want to know more about this, see my article entitled Zionist Anti-Semitism, which is available on several websites. Now, Israel has remained dependent upon Western imperialism for material and political support. Perversely, it has earned this support by suppressing anti-imperialist forces throughout the Middle East. And this role fundamentally explains the support of Western countries, especially the USA. In this role, this support goes back long before there was such a strong Zionist lobby in the USA, which at most can reinforce the intuitions of US imperialist interests. Zionism has always meant occupation, even a state of war against the indigenous Arab population and against neighboring states. Early on, Zionism demonized any resistance as Arab terrorism, thus projecting its own barbarism onto its victims, just as other colonial projects had done throughout the world. However, eventually the Zionist project faced legitimacy problems from the rise of the Palestine Liberation Organization in the 60s, and eventually with the mass uprising of the Intifada, which started in the late 80s. In order to contain that revolt, Israel used many means: physical repression, collective punishment, economic theft and vandalism, and so on. But Israel also developed new political strategies, which had wider convergences in the Middle East. With backing from the USA and the UK, other countries in the region were already promoting political Islam, that is, groups which politicize religion while Islamizing politics. They did so as a new weapon against secular nationalist movements throughout the Arab world. Israel developed its own version of this strategy. Palestinian organizations could not legally receive funds from abroad without permission from the Israeli state, which gave permission to only one such organization, Hamas. Why? Because Hamas, at that time at least, was seen as useful to the occupation. It attacked the secular projects of the PLO. It intimidated women activists in particular, and allowed Israel to portray the resistance as religious, and therefore the conflict as a conflict between Jews being persecuted by anti-Semitic Muslims. As a parallel strategy, Israel also aimed to create an alternative Palestinian leadership, which could be incorporated into the occupation. Eventually, the Palestine National Authority was created along these lines under the Oslo Accord, which aimed to delegitimize Palestinian resistance as terrorism. Since then, more and more Palestinians have seen the PNA for what it is, namely an agent of the occupation to police the Palestinians. Its collaborationist role has discredited secular Palestinian politics in the eyes of many, as it was intended to do by Israel and the USA. By default, Hamas remained a more credible basis for resistance to the occupation and gained more popular support, even if its Islamist agenda created divisions among the Palestinians. More recently, especially since the Second Intifada, the Zionist project has extended its colonization through more settlements and the so-called separation wall. It has blurred all forms of resistance into the concept of terrorism and has treated them accordingly. It has systematically attacked Palestinian civil society, the provision of social services, any kind of social amenities, all as the terrorist infrastructure in the name of protecting Israelis and their democracy. With the rise of Hamas, moreover, as the more credible promoter of resistance, the Zionist storyline could emphasize Islamic terrorism, as if the systemic violence of the occupation arose from religious extremism. Likewise, the Western war on terror justifies its global plunder, illegal wars, and systematic brutality along similar lines, as a defense against terrorism, especially the Islamic variety. This so-called war draws upon colonialist counterinsurgency strategies, which conflated all types of anti-colonial resistance as terrorism. Hence, the redefinition of terrorism in a 1996 law in the USA, so that terrorism now included potentially any resistance which might damage property in pursuit of a political cause. A similar definition was codified under the UK's so-called Terrorism Act 2000, or let's say aptly named Terrorism Act 2000, because it aimed to delegitimize any resistance to the terrorist regimes throughout the world that were being supported by the UK. And on that basis, the UK government, back in 2001, prescribed, that is, banned, a long list of organizations, many of which had support from migrant communities in this country, precisely because those organizations were centrally involved in opposing repressive regimes abroad. That was early 2001. Before the so-called war on terror was declared, but preparing the way for that war, which brings new elements, especially what many have called the blowback effect. That is, Western societies now find themselves being attacked by Islamic terrorist networks which are descended from or related to those which their own governments had sponsored, such as in the campaign against the Afghan regime when it was supported by the Soviet Union. Now there's an extra convergence between Western imperialism and the Zionist project. At the time of the attack in the USA on 11 September 2001, the former Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, happened to be in the USA, where journalists asked him, what did this attack mean for Israel? Thanks to Uri for digging up this thanks to Roland for digging up this quotation for me. He replied, "It's very good for Israel. It will strengthen the bonds between the two peoples. Israelis have suffered from terrorism for years, and now so does the U.S. population." And shortly thereafter, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said, "Together we can defeat the forces of evil," echoing the Bush line about the axis of evil. So in these ways, Sharon rhetorically equated the so-called counter-terror campaign of Israel against Palestinian terrorism, on the one hand, and the war on terror by its Western allies. The equation has become more than rhetorical by turning our political logic upside down. For example, Tony Blair has said, "Peace in the Middle East would be easier to achieve if it were not for terrorism," by which, of course, he means the resistance, not the terrorism inflicted on the Palestinians every day. Likewise, he doesn't mean the terrorism inflicted by other allies of the UK all over the world, such as Turkey against the Kurds, Colombian government against popular movements there, and so on. Following this logic, the Western governments justify the policy of blaming those who resist the Zionist occupation. In fact, Western governments have adopted the Israeli demands that Palestinians renounce terror as a condition for any support for their political rights.
You have a couple of minutes left.
Okay. Moreover, these governments have appropriated elements of Zionist strategy for their own activities. They have learned from Israel for their occupation of Iraq by intensifying ethnic divisions there and inflicting collective punishment upon communities which resist the occupation. Also by analogy, Western governments persecute migrant and Muslim populations at home as a means to deter or disorganize dissent from UK foreign policy, US foreign policy, and so on. At the same time, governments play a double game. They maintain close links with organizations of political Islam and even promote particular individuals as community representatives, you know, representatives of what they call moderate Muslims, at the same time as demanding that these community representatives help the government to counter extremism, vaguely defined, really, to mean any effective resistance against the state terrorism. These maneuvers have several aims: shifting blame away from the government, Islamizing politics within Asian communities, marginalizing progressive Muslim forces, and justifying political surveillance of entire populations. In all these ways, the Zionist project now has a greater affinity with strategies for turning Muslim and migrant communities here into an internal colony. This affinity reinforces Western support for Zionist expansion in Palestine. Now, this overall analysis has implications for strategies about how to oppose the Zionist occupation, especially from within Western countries. Firstly, it would be misguided to make appeals to Muslim religious affinity. This would simply reinforce the Zionist storyline of a religious conflict and would intensify political divisions among those who oppose the occupation, both there in Palestine and here. Secondly, as another example of what not to do, it would also be futile to appeal to the humanity or the interests of Western governments, which clearly support Israel in pursuing their own material interests in imperial plunder. Rather, we should build an alliance of all those who are targeted by the so-called war on terror, both here and abroad. This war does persecute Muslims in particular, but it also instrumentalizes ethnic and religious differences. It targets anyone who resists, regardless of their religious background, and that includes Kurds, Tamils, Sikhs, Colombians, anyone who resists imperial plunder anywhere in the world, and anyone in this country who tries to develop solidarity with that resistance. So in conclusion, only a secular basis can achieve the unity needed to oppose our common enemy. Thank you.
Thank you so much.